Session number 9173, Reel 9.
John Medaway, take 9. Could I now ask you about the Field Marshal's tough image that he seems to have earned? You know, he's often referred to as Hangman Harding or the Mailed Fist.
Yes.
Was this deserved, do you think?
Of course not. Such exaggerations were absurd, but he was certainly a very firm governor, and he saw it as his role to free Cyprus of the curse of political violence and terror, and he got on with the job as he thought best. He wasn't intimidated by criticism and adverse propaganda, another example of his rather remarkable courage. And he'd stuck to his guns, and of course he had the strong support of the Prime Minister and the Colonial Secretary in London. And on the whole, I would have thought that events in Cyprus had rather proved him right about the handling of the emergency. It was sometimes said that if only he'd reprieved a young man under sentence of death, things would have been better, and that an outbreak of violence was even more extreme violence was bound to follow after the executions. Not at all. In fact, when these executions, which everybody, of course, regretted they had to take place, but when they occurred, it was quite noticeable that they had the opposite effect of increasing violence, they tended rather to calm the situation for the time being, at least. But it was a miserable task that he was faced with. But he saw it, I think, as a military operation, a distasteful, grim task that had, however, that was necessary and had to be seen through to a conclusion. Oddly enough, nowadays when you go to Cypress and Greek Cypriots begin talking to you about the British, and inevitably Harding's name crops up, and also Hugh Foote's, they tend to speak with great respect for him now, tend to take the line, well, at least we knew where we were with Harding. He was a straight man, one could expect some measure of justice from him. In fact, he was a man with a great sense of justice, and was scrupulously careful in taking the harsh decisions about matters such as executions, and these were very thoroughly discussed in the Executive Council. It was the duty of the councillors to give advice, though the decision, of course, resting entirely on the governor. And certainly I can remember that in difficult cases there was a very thorough discussion before he reached his final decision. I can't remember that anybody ever dissented on the council, actually dissented from the decision he had reached.
Could I ask you now about the role of the press, particularly the press within Cyprus during the emergency period?
Yeah.
Did you have any problems or support regarding the press?
Well, the Greek press were uniformly hostile. No Greek editor could possibly have been otherwise. And It was so routine, their response, their caricature of Harding, their travesty of British policy and so on, that I suppose one became inured to it and didn't take it all that seriously. And that also went for the kind of political statements which some of the leading Greek Cypriots would make from time to time in the press. So the influence of the press, as far as the British are concerned, was not very great. We had to try to counter the propaganda coming from the newspapers and elsewhere as best we could. But the truth was that there wasn't a great deal we could do directly to, very, very little that we could do directly to inform them, though to influence them, though we did, of course, let out a flood of public information about what we were doing and how we saw the situation. The more important, I think, from the British side was the English language press there, and the reaction at home here in England, because it was here to a large extent that the propaganda, the political battle was being fought. So the reports of what was going in, on in Cyprus, which reached London from the English-speaking newspapers in Cyprus, that was certainly an important factor. There were, too, the Cyprus Mail, which was careful not to expose itself to intimidation, to retaliation, reprisals by EOKA, but on the whole was pretty honest and straightforward. And then there was the Times of Cyprus, run by Charles Foley, which seemed to me, and I think to many others in Cyprus at the time, to be pretty well wholly sold to the Greek side. And may indeed, it was often said that there must be some Greek Cypriot or Ethnarchy money behind the venture. That paper was established just before the emergency began, I believe, and it took a consistently a hostile line to the actions of the colonial administration. The editor, Charles Foley, he'd been, I think, foreign editor of the Daily Express at one time. Anyway, he'd certainly been in Fleet Street, and he naturally had a wide circle of acquaintances, contacts here, including people in the Labour Party. I think he may have been particularly close to people like Tom Dryburgh and Barbara Castle and Lena Yeager. Probably that paper, the Times of Cyprus, had more influence than it merited in local terms because of these external connections.
Did it have much nuisance value for you, that paper? Did it stir up trouble?
It had no value whatsoever. It certainly was a nuisance and a bit of a thorn in the flesh, but it soon emerged that the editor was so prejudiced to the Greek cause and even to the extremism of Enesis that it was difficult to take it very seriously. He did publish some pretty wicked things, including personal attacks on individuals in the British administration, which could conceivably, I suppose, have added to the risks they were exposed to.
Yes, would he have exposed gaps in security as well, ever?
I suppose if he got the chance, yes, he certainly would have done it, but I can't remember specific cases of that kind. I shouldn't be at all surprised to hear that there were such cases.
I believe it was suppressed at one time. Do you have any memory of that?
I don't really recall it. I think you are right, but I cannot, I'm afraid, recall the circumstances.
You've mentioned the Athens radio, that you had quite a lot to put up with, you know, from Athens, and how you managed to jam. Did you have any problems so far as Ankara was concerned? You know, were programmes received on the island from Turkey?
Yes, they certainly were, but they were not hostile to Britain. They were violently hostile to EOKA and the Enesis movement, and to Greece itself on occasions. And then towards the end, when it seemed, when the Turks were worried by the possibility of a change of sovereignty and the British yielding to pressure, sometimes they would turn the heat on a bit from Ankara and be very critical of particular British actions. An example was the Foot Plan in early 1958, when he and Selwyn Lloyd went to Ankara and got a very rough handling from the Turkish Prime Minister and Foreign Minister. There then occurred, while Selwyn Lloyd and Foote were still in Ankara, severe, very grave Turkish Cypriot riots in the Turkish quarter of Nicosia, which were pretty obviously whipped up from Turkey. So on a specific occasion such as that, there were undoubtedly inimical broadcasts from Turkey. But on the whole, Turkish policy was that so long as the British remained firm and stuck to the job in Cyprus, and no change of sovereignty was in view, they were content to support Britain.
Could I ask you now about London and the Labour politicians in London? Did you have any problems in that direction? You have mentioned the connection of Barbara Castle and Dryburgh with Charles Foley, but did you have to suffer a lot of criticism from the Labour Party generally?
They were in opposition at this period, and so it was to be expected that they would seize on opportunities to criticise the government in power for its handling of the whole Cyprus problem. I think their criticism tended to be, on the whole, on the political plane, on questions such as self-determination, rather than on the military plane and the emergency actions, though, of course, individuals, as you rightly say, like Barbara Castle or Lina Jager, would pick up Greek Cypriot versions of what were happening and use these to as a grounds for criticising the government. They certainly were a factor, and of course all the time the certainty that at some time in the future a Labour government would be in power in England was a consideration everybody had to have in mind. On the whole, I think the government in London were fairly successful in preserving a bipartisan approach. But there was one period, I think it was in 1958 when the party did come out quite positively in favour of Enesis. Whether that was simply a reflection of their position as the opposition. Whether they really meant it, I can't possibly say. My guess is that if they had ever found themselves in power and having to deal with the sort of situation which then existed in Cyprus, they would have been forced by the force of circumstances, by the actual realities of the problem, to take a line not very different from that which the Conservatives pursued. But that's is a conjecture on my part.
How about the Anglican Church in Cyprus? Did you have any problems there, you know, regarding criticisms of the policy?
Not really, no. There was one occasion when the Archdeacon preached a sermon which was critical of the behaviour of the soldiers. I think it was after one of these incidents where the troops had reacted badly to the murder of their colleagues, and perhaps got a bit out of hand, but that was not any prominent element in the problem there. At an early stage, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Fisher, had taken a hand and protested very strongly against the deportation of the Archbishop and the conduct of the British, I think, in the negotiations. But and Lord Hardinge had some correspondence with the Archbishop, but that passed off.
Could I ask you now about the Field Marshal's trips to London, which I believe he made several while he was governor? Did you go with him?
On most of them, I think I was there. I can't remember that I went on all of them.
What would your role have been? Why did you go with him? Would it have been advising?
Yes, again, it was to sit in on the conversations, to make such a contribution as I could when asked to do so, and to keep a record for the Field Marshal's use later on. And then, of course, in between any discussions he might have with the Colonial Secretary or senior or other ministers or senior officials, we would get together and discuss what had been said and what response he might usefully make.
Am I right in thinking that you were his main contact with the Cypriots, both Greek and Turks, because you could speak the language and you had such good knowledge of Cyprus?
No, I don't think it would be right to say that. I was certainly one of his contacts, but he had, among the Greek Cypriot and Turkish Cypriot communities, he had people who were prepared to meet and talk to him and offer advice. And then there were Greek and Turkish senior officers in the administration itself. I think he turned to me rather more for generalized advice about the state of opinion in the country and the political impact of various actions. To some extent, I suppose, he drew on my contacts and knowledge of Cypriot personalities. But in fact, I'm afraid the emergency had the effect of cutting me off from many of the people whom I would, in other circumstances, have turned to for opinion and advice.
Who would he have met in London? Would this have been the time of Eden, when Eden was Prime Minister, and then Macmillan?
Yes, the main contact was Alan Lennox Boyd, who was the Colonial Secretary.
Yes.
Then, though, undoubtedly, Hardinge did meet the Prime Minister also. But the main contact was Lennox Boyd and perhaps a few of the leading members of the different parties from time to time.
Did you get any idea of the sort of priority that was placed on Cyprus by these politicians? Were they taking it very seriously?
Having rather neglected or put aside the problem, simply hoping that it wouldn't get worse for so many years, then, of course, we tend to forget, but Cyprus was front page news when the emergency happened and murders were and riots and so on were going on. And undoubtedly, ministers gave it a very high priority. I sometimes felt that it was a pity that they hadn't given it a higher priority in more tranquil times when just possibly something more constructive might have been done.
But at this time, do you think you were given all the support you needed?
I can't recall that that support from London, from ministers, failed in any way at that time.
Mm-hmm. I believe quite a bit of money was forthcoming regarding the development plan.
Yes.
From 56.
Yes,
is that right?
Yes, it was. It was considered that it would be politically wise actually to increase the rate of development during this period, partly so as to take people's minds off off the violence a bit, and also to underline the advantages of the British connection. And so a great deal was undertaken at this time in spite of the adverse circumstances, and funds were forthcoming from London.
Could I now ask you about the end of the Field Marshal's period, which would be towards the end of 57, because I believe he came out to Cyprus,
yes,
for 2 years. How did you assess his role at the end of that two-year period? You have mentioned,
yes,
already, you know, his considerable
achievement. Well, I think he'd he'd achieved a great deal towards defeating Eoka, not only on the military plane. In fact, Eoka could not be defeated, so to speak. It's very rarely that you can defeat a terrorist organization. But towards the end of 1957, they'd been fought to a standstill. But we'd scotched the snake, not killed it, and it was there on the ground with its organisation, battered but still in being, a threat at any time in the future. But still, what Harding had succeeded in doing was making it perfectly obvious that terrorism and violence would not succeed and would not bring off their aim of uniting Cyprus with Greece. Then, on the political side, I think he had really played a very crucial role in getting ministers and everybody else concerned to think deeply about the real problem in Cyprus, the final status of the island, instead of simply carrying on with pre-established positions. He was prepared to tackle the underlying problems directly, head-on, so to speak. And he'd started, as you know, with a formula which he'd given to Archbishop Makarios, which virtually said, yes, it's not our position that self-determination will never be applied to Cyprus, but we can't see that it's a possibility meanwhile at the present time, or even in the foreseeable future. So meanwhile, for goodness sake, let's get on with restoration of peace and order and self-government. Then he'd got the government to try out on the Turks the possibility of some form of conditional enesis at a distant time in the future. He'd then gone on from there after that that initiative failed. He'd gone on to discuss the possibility of partition if it ever came to self-determination. And once again, his position was that partition was not in itself a good thing or a desirable outcome, but it was a lesser evil in terms of the future of the Cypriots, both Greek and Turk, relations between Greece and Turkey and British defence and allied interests, that partition was a lesser evil than that of enesis. So we'd reached the point where Britain had said, yes, when self-determination is applied, and we can't say when that will be, the Turks will have a right of self-determination as well as the Greeks. That had, in a way, made the deadlock... don't think it would be fair to say it made the deadlock worse, but it certainly hadn't done anything to resolve it. And I think the significant thing in the concluding phase of Harding's governorship was that came round to the view that there would never be a peaceful solution of the Cyprus problem unless the two extremes of enesis and partition could first be excluded, and that that would then open the way for some compromise settlement, but that in some way or other the two extremes, the bugbears of Cyprus, had first to be excluded. And he had put fairly specific ideas on this to London, and they happened to fit in quite well with initiatives which Mr. Spark, the Secretary General of NATO, was taking at that time. Now, this was a great, an important development, it seems to me, in British policy on Cyprus.
For 2 years, you were his right hand, as he has described you.
No. One of his helpers.
Well, how would you sum up your relationship with Lord Harding during this time?
I don't think I've worked for anybody for whom I felt the same combination of respect and affection. He was a very remarkable man, and looking back on it, I'm very glad to have had the privilege to have had the opportunity of working with him. Mm-hmm.